Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with actor Lynn Doyle, who's here in Sarasota as part of the ensemble cast of The Glass Menagerie, Tennessee Williams' iconic play, which will be opening at the Players Theater on October 2nd. Listen to Lynn talk about a life in which, at every turn, she made a choice, and as she says, all those choices brought her where she is today, and she wouldn't be anywhere else than she is today. So she is a woman who has no regrets. Would that we could all say that. So listen to how Lynn did it. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down survive, finding wisdoms otherwise. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
about being who you really are. Not being some version of who you are. Not being the person you think someone else would want you to be. Not being the person you think you were supposed to be. Or, as many of us are, the person you think will get you loved, appreciated, hired, whatever it is you want. I knew a person once who told me quite clearly that he could be kind of whatever other people needed him to be at the moment. He would even wear the clothes that were appropriate to the kind of people he was hanging out with, and they would be very different, so he would have, you know, wardrobes for the different people that he was trying to impress or trying to have like him. I don't know if you're listening, if that has any meaning for you. I've used this example before of people who say, I didn't even know if I liked the movie until I heard somebody else, usually my spouse, saying what he or she thought of the movie. So lots of us are doing this. Lots of us are demonstrating ways of being people that we are not. I have recently come across a quote of Joseph Campbell's. I don't know if you know who Joseph Campbell was. he spent a life studying myth and made quite a career of telling us about the myths of the world. Perhaps his most famous book is Hero with a Thousand Faces, on which the Star Wars legend is based. And this quote is, "The privilege of a lifetime is being who you are," which could be the logo for the Lin Show. So, are you enjoying the privilege of a lifetime? Are you who you are? Most of the examples I gave a few seconds ago are conscious. These are examples of people trying to demonstrate something that may or may not be true for them, trying to appear to be something or other, whether they are or are not it. And they know that they're doing that. It's a conscious choice. I am allowing myself to look like somebody I'm not so that this person will like me, love me, hire me, pay me, not hurt me. This reminds me of a story from my own childhood. I looked very, very young. And when I graduated from college, I went looking for a job. And I had a lot of experience at what it was I wanted to do, but nobody would hire me. And my mother said, you have to wear a hat. And I, in my early, in my rebellion, said, oh, really? What, are they going to hire the hat? Ha, ha. Well, after the next few turndowns, I actually wore a hat, and damn if I didn't get the job. So sometimes that's accurate. Sometimes you can put on something that will say to someone else, you know, this is who I want. And we can make those choices consciously. But what I'm talking about here are the choices that we made when we were very, very young. And those choices were based on experiences that we had that told us that something about us was not okay. This can happen, as I have said any number of times, in the family of origin. That is often where that happens. But it can happen on the schoolyard. You can be somebody who doesn't dress the way the rest of the kids do, or who takes different food to school than the other kids do, or is a different color, or has different kind of hair, or any way in which you are different can be used by kids and grown-ups to tell you in no uncertain terms that there's something wrong with you, that you are bad, wrong, evil, ugly, unattractive, undesirable. This, of course, is intolerable. We cannot bear this as children. So if this happens to you in your family of origin, that's about as bad as it can get. If your parents don't like what you are, then you believe you're not okay. But it, as I said, it can happen on the playground. It can happen in school. Teachers quite often, either intentionally or unintentionally, disparage a child or say unpleasant things to a child, sometimes because they're incapable of controlling a situation, and so they use their adult sarcasm to put down a child. Religions can do this. Our culture can do this. There are any number of places that we can run into someone who thinks we are not okay. And while I brought up the idea of sarcasm, I want to take a moment to say a lot of people think that sarcasm is cleverness. They think it's funny. They think it's a statement of how smart they are. Actually, sarcasm is cruelty. It is nothing but cruelty. It's an attempt to hurt another person and thereby shut them down. So if you are someone who is being attacked by sarcasm, please understand that the people who use sarcasm are people who are feeling inadequate to the task of defending themselves. It's a last resort. I know it makes them look clever and they think they're clever, but what they're doing is hiding their own inadequacy behind their, quote, cleverness. If you are someone who grew up in a family that used sarcasm, and so you learn to use it, let me assure you, it is simply cruelty. And you can develop skills to help you in your interactions which don't require the use of sarcasm. Okay, that's a diversion, but since I had brought it up, I felt compelled to make this point. It's because sarcasm is quite often used by people who are very smart, and I'd like to help them understand that it is not their intelligence that's operating here, but their insecurity. They're using their intelligence in the service of their insecurity. Okay, so there are lots of ways that we can get the idea that we are not okay. And as I've said, if you've been listening, what happens when we have that is we create a story. We hide whatever quality it was to the extent that we are capable of doing it. And we pretend that we are not that, don't have that, didn't mean that. And over time, we get so good at that we forget. And then we think we are somebody who doesn't have that. And we hide those qualities which we understood were going to bring us criticism or, at the very least, not get us what we wanted. And then we are in the world as somebody we are not, or at least somebody who is not all of who we are. And we are denied the privilege of a lifetime to be who we are. Now, this is unconscious. If you laughed out loud in your class and you had a kind of funny laugh, and a student or a teacher laughed at you or made fun of you, and you decided that that was not okay, and you learned how to suppress that laugh, then you might very well come into adulthood unable to laugh spontaneously. You may think of yourself as someone who doesn't have much of a sense of humor, or you may even think of yourself as someone who's above silliness and is then judgmental of other people who have spontaneous belly laughs. You may do to others what was done to you in the belief that you aren't that person. You don't have spontaneous ha ha ha. Well, of course, life is diminished by your inability to spontaneously find joy and happiness and laughter. But of course, you don't know that you're suppressing it. You think that this is who you are, someone who can't do it. So the Lynn Show is all about making the point that the privilege of a lifetime is being who you are, and that if you needed to suppress something in your childhood, it's not too late to get it back, and it is so important to try. Because not only don't you have access to these things, but the energy that it takes to suppress them is energy you don't have to do with whatever it is you want to do in your life. Today I want to talk a little bit about what I call the relationship contract. This is, I believe, one of the things that stops people from making changes in their life. When you begin a relationship, and this is every relationship, so it's your relationship with your parents or your siblings or your grandparents or your aunts and uncles, your neighbors, your friends, your teachers, classmates, and then as you get older, perhaps different friends, employers, employees, neighbors, again, spouses, children, boyfriends, girlfriends. Every time you establish a relationship, I believe that you sign on, both of you, to a contract that I'm calling the relationship contract. It is unconscious. It's not written down. And it only has one clause. And that clause is, I will be who I am, and you be who you are. And as long as you're in that relationship, the other person expects you to continue to be who you were when you signed onto this contract, to continue to live up to your contract. Well, if you change something in your life that affects the way you are in this contract, and by the way, generally speaking, we establish the same or similar contracts with everybody. Who it is that we think we are, who we're offering, we offer to everyone. There may be some exceptions where you are able to be more who you are with someone, but on the generally speaking, the person that you demonstrated in your family of origin is the person you're demonstrating in your current family with your spouse and your children. The person that you demonstrated with your friends on the playground are probably the same qualities that you are demonstrating with whoever are your friends today. So let me give you an example. Let's say you learned in your childhood that, well, I'll give you an example. I had a client. Oh, I forgot to say I'm a psychotherapist, so in case you're listening for the first time, this is where all of this is coming from. I'm a psychotherapist. And a client of mine tells this story of how when she was very little, she didn't eat. She didn't like to eat very much, and she was very thin, and her parents were very worried about her. And so they took her to the doctor in an attempt to help her gain weight. And she got the idea that what her parents wanted was not a thin daughter. And so she learned how to fatten up. So you can imagine that later in life, she was stuck with this image of herself. It's connected to her relationship with her parents. This is what she thought her parents wanted. This is what she gave her parents. And so no diets would work. No, she couldn't figure out a way to lose any of this weight. Well, not surprisingly, a lot of her relationships were based on this. She had friends who were overweight. She, in her intimate relationships, she was teased and cajoled, and do you really need that piece of cake, and did you go to the gym, and all that kind of stuff. And she continued to present this image of this person who could not get a hold of this, could not lose the weight, even though most of the people in her life were encouraging her to lose the weight. Even though most of her relationships were based on the fact that she was not able to lose the weight. So, fortunately, we were able to help her. That's a very long story, which if you want to hear, you can read my book. When you can, you will, or you can call me. And I'll tell it to you. We managed to help her. She lost a great deal of weight. And what happened was her friends did not want to be her friends. Her family went on treating her as though she was still overweight. She had gone back for a wedding. She lived far away from a lot of her family for a while. She'd gone back for the wedding. She couldn't wait to show them the new her. They ignored it entirely and continued to chastise her about what she was eating and whether she was working out. And they just ignored it entirely. And friends with whom her relationship had been based on helping each other, reading diet books, putting on what they used to call fakey facade clothing so that they didn't see it so clearly, making fun of thin people. This, she could no longer do this. And many of her friends became unable to be with her. And this is how it goes, that when you break a relationship contract, the people with whom you have had that contract, they haven't broken it. They don't understand why you are not the person with whom they have been in this long-term relationship. And it can cost you sometimes many, sometimes important relationships. I saw an episode of Oprah once in which she explained that when she lost all that weight, she got hate mail from listeners who had said, you know, we thought you were one of us. So when you want to change something significant about yourself, be prepared. I am not telling you that you shouldn't do it. I think you should do it. I think that this client was healthier and in the long run happier for being able to be who she really was, which was a thin person. But it did cost her, and there was pain involved. So, the Lynn Show, it's about recognizing that you may not be who you really are. There may be a change that you want to make, that you've struggled with and tried to make and haven't been able to. And one of the reasons may be that this thing that you want to change will have an impact on your relationship contracts, an impact which, for the moment, you are not ready to endure. So, I mentioned that you could call me. Actually, you can email me. You can go to my website, thelynshow.com. That's T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com. There's a button to click to email me. You can ask me a question. You can leave me your email address and ask me and I'll get back to you. You can get me to talk to your group or organization. If you belong to a group that is struggling with something and you want some information about how to handle that, how to tackle it, how to deal with the inevitable breaking of relationship contracts, I'm available for that. You can get a copy of my book in which I tell this story. It's called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. Also, on the website, you can listen to all of my shows, including the one I'm doing now, and listen to all the interviews, including the one I'm about to air. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, which I'm about to explain to Lynn Doyle. I do this because when you listen to people who do that, then at least in this area, you are hearing what it really sounds like to have the privilege of a lifetime and be who you really are. And so now, why don't we hear it from Lynn Doyle? Okay, I'm here with Lynn Doyle, and I'm interviewing Lynn because she is going to be appearing in the Glass Menagerie at the Players Theater opening on October 2nd. Yes. So I'm just explaining to Lynn that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it is clear that you are doing that, trying to do that, sometimes doing that with the art of acting.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes,
okay,
correct.
Good. So I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the first time in your life, the earliest moment you can remember that acting looked attractive, called you, people said, oh, aren't you cute, something like that?
Well, the first time, I can very distinctly remember the first time I saw live theater other than school plays, and I was in the fifth grade, and my dad took me for my birthday into, we were living outside of Washington, we went into the city, and he took me to see Carousel. Mm-hmm. And we used to, he used to love to play that album, and he would play it, and he would cry, and we, you know, we'd kind of do it together, so when it came down to see this show, and there I sat in the audience next to him, and I was kind of singing along, but, you know, softly, but I remember the people around me. I think they thought it was kind of cute that this little kid knew all the words. But that was the first time I thought, wow. Now, whether or not I ever thought I would be capable of doing that, I'm not sure.
Well, fifth grade is 10?
10. 10. Mm-hmm. 11, yeah.
Okay. This is real interesting because your dad was so clearly moved by it, right?
Oh, yes.
So that's a very powerful message right there.
Yes.
That this is something that has an impact on my dad. I mean,
yes.
You know, really.
I'd always thought acting, I thought it was, I loved participating in school plays and
well,
so
were you doing that before this event or?
You mean before going to, with
yeah.
my dad?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would do, you know, the school assembly things, and that was all really great. And then, when we moved to Huntington, New York, and I did junior high school plays and things, but it became more apparent as I got older that I loved sports, and girls were really encouraged to do sports in my high school, which was wonderful. And I did the choir and all that, but at some point I needed to make a choice,
yeah.
I think. And I always felt like the theater kids kids kind of looked down on the athletic kids. I'm not sure it was vice versa, but be that as it may, well, it was interesting because I went to a class reunion a couple of years ago, and I just happened to be in a play, and so I had the script with me, and I was leaving this brunch to go to the airport, and my script was out because I was taking it on the plane, and one of the theater kids, who hardly ever talked to me, she looked over, she said, "Oh, you're still doing theater?" I really never did it when you knew it, but then, you know, and I've always loved to, you know, and in college I didn't, because the theater kids did, but I love going and watching and all.
So this is really interesting. You're drawn to it, you're drawn to it, you're drawn to it, but you feel like somehow it's not right?
I didn't feel confident that I could do it, yeah. And there were kids that were clearly the theater kids.
Right.
And why, I don't know. I don't know. But when I got out of college, a couple of years out of school, I was working at the college I'd gone to, and the guy that was director of public relations had been a theater major at the college. And he decided to use the small theater of the university for summer shows. And he said, so you really didn't make me audition or anything. There was really no fear. So I did a couple of summers of that, and then I moved, and, you know, I was interested in, you know, getting married and having children and all that stuff. So my older son, though, was always very dramatic and theatrical and everything. We wanted to get, so we thought, well, let's get him involved in the Columbus Children's Theater. And we did, and he had a wonderful experience and loved it, and went on until he was in high school and then started doing high school things. But I loved the Columbus Children's Theater, and we would still go there and support it and so on. Well, he graduated from high school and went on, and I missed him terribly. And I thought, kind of the light bulb went off. Because I had been very much involved in his high school with, as a parent, you know, in
right.
Children.
Right.
So I auditioned at the Columbus Children's Theater because they used adults and did not get cast.
That was very brave.
But
and
you know, the thing was, Lynn, my son had auditioned the first time and did not get cast. And I remember looking at that little face, and he was, you know, sobbing. He was so upset. But 6 months later, he auditioned again, and I learned from him,
yeah.
This little 10-year-old could get back up on that horse. Well, I can get back. So I auditioned again and got cast. And
in that, what? Do you remember?
It was an adaptation of the Christmas Carol called Ebenezer. It was with original music, and I played, you know, I had like two lines or something. It wasn't a big deal, but it kind of got me
in.
And from there, you know, I did a lot of stuff at the Columbus Children's Theater, but then began branching out and doing other community theater and some semi-professional in that we were paid.
Mm-hmm.
So then when we moved here, of course, I wanted to maintain that, and we moved to Venice. One of the reasons we moved to Venice was that the Venice Theater was right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I auditioned at the Venice Theater and thought, you know, I'm not a diva. I'm going to go in and just be, I got cast in the chorus of Annie, and Murray Chase threw me a few lines, which was kind of fun, and then it began, and then the next time I auditioned, it was for Romeo and Juliet as nurse, and so that was, you know, a wonderful thing, and over time,
Wait a minute, have you had any training?
No training, no.
No, I
had done Shakespeare in Columbus.
That was my question,
yeah.
I mean, to audition for a Shakespeare play, it's a big deal. So what do you mean you've done Shakespeare in Columbus?
I had done Taming of the Shrew. We did a cross-gender version, and I had a very small part. I guess that was the only Shakespeare. Then I did like Cyrano, which was not Shakespeare. But so I had just studied on, you know, Shakespeare, and I will say that Murray was a wonderful teacher.
So I'm kind of interested in this. I mean, I think it's very brave to audition for Shakespeare when you've done just a little bit of it and you haven't studied it. It's very courageous, I think.
Well, I had a wonderful director in Columbus who, you know, taught us a lot.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, he was fantastic. He was a faculty member at a community college and had a lot of theater training, was a wonderful guy. But then Murray actually spent a lot of time. We started rehearsing in October. The show didn't go up until April.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, which was wonderful for me because it helped to learn those lines. I mean, it's hard enough to learn lines, but to learn. So he sat with us. The whole cast, it was age appropriate. So the majority of the cast were young people, high school kids, who had never had any exposure to it. And so it was wonderful that he helped us, all of us, to develop the correct meter and all that stuff. So it was courageous, but I thought, what the heck, why not? What do I have to lose? I thought, I'll be brave.
Yes.
I don't have anything to lose.
No, and I think that's a very important, you know, so many people are stopped by the inability to do just what your son did and what you did, you know?
Well, he is my inspiration. He has been my inspiration about things like that. You have to take one step or you're never going to know.
Yeah.
I mean, the answer is always going to be no unless you take that step.
So. Yeah, it's true, but there are lots of people who don't know that. Yeah. So,
well, I wasn't sure how many people down here had actually done a lot of Shakespeare, so I kind of thought, well, maybe I have. You know, I had done some monologues, some Shakespearean monologues, and so, you know, whether it was the greatest production in the world, I don't know, but it was a wonderful experience for me because it's one of those things that seems impossibly difficult, so that when you achieve it, you think, what could be any harder than that?
Oh, it's wonderful. You know? It's so wonderful.
Yeah.
So, okay, so so since then, you've just been...
Oh, I did a lot at the... Not a lot, you know, 4 or 5 shows at the Venice Theater. And then last year, I ventured out, auditioned at the Players. Again, my first audition, I didn't get cast. And then maybe I two... No, just one. And then I was in The Boys Next Door last summer that Elliot directed. And I had... I was 3 different characters, all very small, but it was a wonderful experience, got my foot in the door, and then I've also, at the Players, I did Sordid Lives this spring, and then I did Dixie Swim Club this summer, and I did Talking With all of the Players.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and then last fall, I did Our Town up at Bradenton, so that was my first exposure up there, but that's kind of a hike.
Yeah,
from Venice to Bradenton. But the nice thing was there were 3 of us, so we carpooled. And
oh,
it made it wonderful. Yeah.
Well, but it seems to me you've found a niche here. I mean, you know.
Well, there's still a lot of things I don't get cast for because I try to audition pretty much for everything that has an age appropriate or an appropriate
role, right.
part
mm-hmm.
for me, and right. There aren't that many,
no.
So you got to jump on them. And I mean, I've gotten rejected a lot at the Venice Theater because that's where I've auditioned. Unfortunately, I've had a little more luck at Players and Bradenton. Well, I only auditioned there once and got in, so it was a nice experience. That's a beautiful theater up there too.
Oh, you mean Manatee?
Manatee.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
What were you in up there?
I was in Our Town in the small theater.
Oh, really? Did you like working in the small theater?
It's a lovely space and it's a beautiful facility. I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the green room and all of that, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
Beautiful building. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, but, yeah.
Who directed you there?
Candace McLaughlin. She works at the Venice Theater.
Oh, so you know her.
I kind of knew her. I had actually auditioned for her a couple times and didn't get cast down in Venice for things, but then she went up there and, yeah, it was great.
So, I want to sort of lay on this point that so much of acting as a career, either as a life or, you know, mm-hmm. making your living, it's about accepting the fact that other people will not see you in a role that you can see yourself in, you know?
It's a very, I could never do this as my livelihood because I just don't have thick enough skin. I cannot, and as much as I read about, you know, when you're not accepted for a part, it's nothing personal. You can't help it. I can't help but take it personally. I can't help it. I mean, what else is it but me that I'm projecting to you, so presenting to you? And, you know, the nicest times are when a director will actually call you and say whatever the reason was.
Right.
Because they always say, you know, it's not you, it's that this, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it's so subjective. You may think X actor is a great actor, and I may not like that person, care for that person at all.
Well, and there are other reasons that people get cast, beside the fact that they are a good actor or not.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it's true. And beside the fact that they're appropriate, there are lots of reasons that people get cast
right.
that have nothing to do with what one might think is,
exactly.
right?
Okay. Exactly.
So, but what's so interesting about you is that while you say, this is terrible and painful and you couldn't do it for a living and you take it personally, you just keep coming back. So
I know. What is up with that? I don't know. Well, I think, yeah, because I just love it so much.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it so much that the joy of getting cast and doing a play overtakes the rejection, and you hope that you have more acceptances than you do rejections. And I shouldn't even say rejections because that's not an appropriate word, but not
but that's what
cast.
It feels like.
Yeah,
I know. But I think what you said is really so important, that that the joy of the thing is so powerful, you know?
It's funny because I love the process. Mm-hmm. I love my favorite thing, I can't even wait, is the first read-through. Sit around the table reading the play. I love it, and I love watching it evolve and evolve, and then you add this, and you add that, and then you have the set, and you have the costumes, and the wigs, and the makeup, and then it's good. And if I never had to perform the show in front of an audience, I really don't think I'd care, because I love that process.
Wow.
And it was funny, we had rehearsal last night, and it was just me and the young man that plays my son, and we had done little 4 pages that we were supposed to be doing, and he said, hey, you know, if we're done early, would you mind going back and doing what we had done the night before? And I said, no, are you kidding? I would love to do that. Who would say no? I mean, I can't imagine saying no. I love doing it, I'd do it 1,000 times, you know? I do it every day. I walk around with my script and just doing it.
Well, so you're something of an enigma, right? I mean, on the one hand, I love it, I would do it for nothing, I don't care if I get to perform, I just love the process so much, and I'm so, it's so painful to be, not to be cast. On the other hand, I mean, it's an interesting dilemma for people who feel about it the way you feel about it.
I'm very passionate about
it.
Yes. And I don't just take these auditions lightly. I prepare and prepare and prepare. I have an audition coming up in a few weeks. As soon as I heard the play, what the play was going to be, I got the script, and I haven't been studying it because I've had some other things to do, but I am thinking about it, not because I've got to do this, but it's just kind of like in the back of my
mm-hmm.
mind, it's
yeah.
just kind of there, and I really invest a lot of myself in it, so when I don't get cast, it's painful because I've given and haven't gotten anything in back for that particular
It's so audition. Interesting, and it's interesting to me that, I mean, do you mind at all that you didn't do this as a career?
No, I don't think I ever could have done it as a career. But would I have liked to have done it when I was younger? Maybe. But I liked what I was doing then. I mean, I
right.
liked being with my kids and
no, I
having
understand.
A job and all
I
that.
I understand. Yeah. What you're saying, what I hear you saying is that I honored myself. You know, I wanted to be where I was when I was
yes.
there. And now I'm here, so I want to be doing this, and I'm honoring
Oh,
this.
I don't look back with regrets at all at anything. I don't regret anything. I had a guy I took an acting class from once who, we were working on a scene, and he was talking about regrets. And he said, well, you don't tell me you don't regret something. Maybe little things. But no, who lives their life regretting what they did? No, I'm everything I did got me to here, and I'm happy here. So
I love it. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that is what you are in every aspect of your life. And at the moment, you are an actor.
Yes.
Okay, so shall we talk a little bit about Glass Menagerie?
Yes.
Are you Mommy?
I'm Mommy, Amanda.
Oh, Mommy, wow.
Yeah, she's a fascinating character.
Yes, she is. Yeah. Tell me just whatever comes to mind about. I don't know whether the people listening have ever seen or read Glass Menagerie. I mean, God knows it's been done, right. But still, actually, I don't think, I mean, it's been done, it hasn't been done here in a long time. So
it's an American classic. And
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a typical Tennessee Williams where, you know, he has issues with mother and and I think you can see this play from different perspectives. I, as a woman who have raised kids, I think I maybe look at her a little differently than, say, the director who does not have any children, and the young man that plays my son, who obviously is young and
right.
Because some people think she is a controlling person, but her controllingness isn't for the sake of control. It's out of fear and it's out of desperation that she has to control this or her whole life is just going to fall apart. Basically, it's about a family, a mother and an older mother and 2 adult children who are living in a tenement in St. Louis in the 30s and struggling. And the young man, the son, all he wants to do is leave. And he wants to be a writer. And they don't have any source of income other than him. And mom has tried to get the daughter enrolled in business college. She's tried to help her. This young girl is painfully, painfully shy, pathologically shy. And so, you know, fails at everything because she just can't, she can't view the world. So the mother gets the idea, I'm going to find her a man. And some people might think, oh, but she's not, she's doing that because she knows she's not going to be around someday. And she knows he wants to leave.
Right.
What's going to become of this? And this girl is also crippled.
Mm-hmm.
So also my husband, their father, left like 16 years ago. So that's another reason she's had all these all this time. She's had to be the one, and I guess she did work. Oh, yeah, she worked. She works at a department store, has worked at a department store, has had odd jobs, I think. But she's worried about the future for this girl, and that's what motivates her to be controlling. And can she be a pain in the neck? Yes. But she loves these kids, is the way I look at it.
God, this is so interesting. I'm so glad you're saying this because she gets such a bad rep.
Absolutely.
You know?
People think she's a witch. And
that's
she
right.
even has a line in here, my devotion has made me a witch, and so I have become hateful to my children.
Oh, my. And that's the image that you have of that one has that I have.
That's right.
Of that character.
That's right.
It's wonderful that somebody like
that. But I don't see it that way.
No, that's right.
And I had to, you know, and I see her as, it's, she's not motivated by herself. And she even says that. She's a line. She said, you've got to get your sister married. Well, it's not for me because I'm basically going to be gone, is what she says. It's a very sad play, too.
Yes.
It's a very, very sad play because I don't want to give it away what happens, but it doesn't end happily, let's just say that.
No, and it's sad for everybody.
Everybody.
All right.
It's and the interesting thing about it that I hadn't really realized is, until I was doing this particular play, it's all a memory play. So this the person who is narrating the play is Tom, my son, as an adult, and he's telling the story, and then he comes down and is in the story.
Right.
So you wonder how much of this is true,
yeah,
or how much of it is his memory. And taking that a step further, Amanda, who was always talking about, you know, her gentleman callers, how much of her memory is true?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she talks about she got 17 gentlemen calls. Well, I suspect the next time she tells the story, there may be 21 gentlemen calls. And you know, if she had all these gentlemen callers, and if she was this Miss Popularity,
yeah,
and
right,
why didn't she end up marrying one of these great guys instead of marrying this loser who skipped out on her?
Right.
I don't know. You know, was she really as popular as she says, or wasn't she? I don't know. There are all these questions, you know, that you...
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say that I think it's lovely that someone like you is playing this character.
Oh, thank you.
I really do, because I think that with a character like this, there's a temptation to make her one-dimensional.
Absolutely.
You know? And that because of your own personal life experience and who you are, you infuse her with more humanity, and she's a more complicated character. I love it.
I hope that that comes across. It's easy for me to tell you what I'm saying. I hope you see that, you know, when you see the play, that's what she is. I hope that's understood. And she doesn't really, she may seem angry sometimes, and I really try to, I'm really trying to talk to the director about that, because her anger, what appears to be anger, is more frustration. And you know how sometimes when you get so frustrated and you start crying?
Right.
Not because you're crying, but because you're a little frustrated.
Yes, right.
And that's kind of how it is with this. She's so frustrated and desperate that it comes across as angry sometimes. I hope the audience is sophisticated enough to understand that.
Yeah. Right.
Well, there's a scene where she comes in, where the mother comes in, the second scene in the play, and realizes that the daughter has not been going to business college. The mother didn't realize that. And so I really don't put this
in,
but I didn't want to play it angry. And I had a wonderful woman who I adore, who is a theater person, been a theater person here for years. She's in her 70s. And she said, I just hope that second scene where she comes in, I've seen it played angry. That's not the way it's supposed to be played. It's supposed to be... And I'm thinking, please don't come see this show.
I think that what we're talking about here is the... I think nuance is very important and often not achieved in theater.
I agree.
You know, so I'm really I will know whether you are able to pull that off or not. That was what you intended. I will know that. And everybody who's listening who comes to see the show will be looking.
Well, my problem is that my voice is such that with the timbre of my voice tends to sound angry even when I'm not angry. So I'm really trying to soften that. I hope. I mean, I hope it comes across okay. But
yeah, but one of the things that is coming out of this discussion is how complicated acting is.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's. I think people don't understand how complicated it is, how difficult it is to get into somebody else's skin,
mm-hmm.
and do that as a real thing, not as a sort of, I don't know what another word for it is, you know, just sort of pretend.
Well, that's
know?
Right. What's the quote? It's acting is easy, but it's not simple, or something like that, where it really is complicated. There'll be times in rehearsal where we've done the scene and the director will say, okay, now on this line, I want like 3 exclamation points after that. And I'm thinking I had just gone, you know, away. And when they say that, you're really? I thought I had.
Right.
And so obviously you didn't, because right. they don't want to tell you something.
No.
You know. So that's it, you know, being able to get it across, and that's where you have to have complete faith in your director.
I agree.
That he or she is going to have you do the right thing.
Well, because you have to do what the director said. So, and that's another thing that I think that people don't know. I mean, really, the director is the boss.
Absolutely.
So whether you agree or not, you wind up doing what theoretically you wind up,
right.
or
and
you
I
won't
think,
work with them
well,
again.
And Elliot Rains, our director, is a very collaborative
yes.
director. And
right.
you can, I mean, he has a certain way that he sees it, but he will listen to ideas,
mm-hmm.
and as long as you're able to give a good justification, and sometimes he may still say, I still want to do it my way.
Right.
And my feeling is, he is the director, he has a lot more experience than I do, I'm going to do it his way. I trust him.
Yes. It's lovely that you do, and I know Elliot and have interviewed him several times, and I know how he prepares a script.
Right.
I've seen it.
Right.
So, whether you trust him or not, that's the job. The job is to do what the director says, you know? So, and I don't think people understand that either. I think people blame the actor quite often.
You
right.
get a review, you read a review, and you
right.
think, but that's what the director wanted me to do, so why are you criticizing
me?
Right. My goal is to do what the director tells me to
yeah,
do.
That's the job. And I do think that people don't, I mean, it, obviously some critics don't understand it.
No.
You know, they don't. No, right. Okay, so the other question I ask is, having spent the time that you have spent
mm-hmm.
pursuing acting, working as an actor, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Well, it is very hard, but I think, you know, I love the line from A League of Their Own, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And so, in a way, it almost puts you above the rest, because nobody else is going to get up there. It's the guy out there, you know, in the arena, getting bloody, as Teddy Roosevelt said, that is the one, you know? And so, to me, it's such a wonderfully rewarding experience, and I love meeting the people and getting to know different types of people. But, you know, when we were talking about directors, I will say that, to me, it's all about the director. There have been some wonderful plays that I wouldn't audition for because I didn't respect the director. It has nothing to do with liking. And conversely, there have been some, like, mediocre plays, but I like the director, and I respect them for what they do, and so I would do it. So to me, it's all about who the director is. And now that I've been here longer, I've gotten to know the players a little bit more, and it makes it a little bit easier to be, you know, choosy, I guess, if you will. But you know, the other thing I love about acting at my age is that it keeps my brain moving. Mm-hmm. It keeps my brain moving. And my father had dementia, and I'm trying everything I can to ward that off if I can. Yes. And having to learn lines like this, I hope, is going to keep that away for as long as possible. So,
yeah, I think that's very admirable. I guess what strikes me most about you is your ability to inhabit whatever you're doing at the time. You know, mm-hmm. to say, well, I'm a wife and mother, that's what I am, and I love that, and I give that everything, and I do that with, you know, to the best of my ability and with all of my joy and passion, mm-hmm. and now I'm an actor, so I do that like that, and I think that's amazing. And
well, I must say that I have to give, my husband is very supportive, and if I didn't have a supportive spouse, it would be impossible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm rehearsing 5 nights a week, mm-hmm. He works during the day, I work during the day, so we see each other at times like 2 ships passing in the night, but I think he understands that it makes me so happy that it's going to, that it ultimately, you know, brings joy into our family, although he gets tired of running lines with me, I will say that. And I try not to do it too much because I like him to know, to come in and be somewhat surprised by what the play is about.
No, too late.
I'm sure he's sitting back there just mouthing all of my lines as I do them.
That is another very important point.
Absolutely.
The point, I quite often make this point when I talk to young people about the support of their families and mm. how they could not really do this without that. And this is the same.
That's right.
The same. So kudos to him.
Absolutely,
right.
Kudos to him.
Right. And to you.
Well, we have been in plays where, oh, come on, let's go out tonight after rehearsal. And I look around and I thought, none of you have spouses or significant others. That's why you can do this.
Right.
But I want to go home.
Yeah.
Not only do I want to go, but I know he wants me to come home. So at times it does make it tough to have that camaraderie with your cast, but you can only do so much, you know.
Well, and again, what it says is that things don't have to be perfect to be really good.
Absolutely.
You know?
Right.
And that accommodations can be made so that everybody can get what they need. I think it's a wonderful...
And there are ebbs and flows. I mean, there are times where I haven't done a show for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I've been on kind of a roll. But I know that'll stop. That'll happen. It's not going to keep going. There are always, you know...
Maybe not.
But that play doesn't go up until February, so I do have somewhat of a lull. But our son is getting married, so that I sort of had to put a priority on that.
this is lovely. Thank you
Good.
So much.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Appreciate it.
How could anyone have regrets? She says. Of course, this can only be spoken by someone who is in fact being who she is. She is drawn to theater. She knows she likes it, but she's also not drawn to athletics. She doesn't feel quite right with the theater kids, so she goes to the place where she feels right. She gets married, she has children. That's where she feels right. And then when that is less intrusive in her life, requires less attention, she gets to do this thing that she didn't get to do earlier in life, because that's where she wants to be. So, you know, it's the privilege of being who you are. And Lynn has that privilege. She is willing to make the choices that reflect who she really is. And as always, I hope that as you were listening, you were asking yourself, when these choices came up in your life, did you choose what you really wanted to do? Or did you choose what somebody else thought you had to do, or should do, or would be right for you to do? Or did you choose what other people were choosing? Did you choose what you thought would make you acceptable in some way? Did you deny yourself? And do you have regret? And if there are some things, or is something that you denied, hid, pretended you were not. Do you want it back? So, remembering what I said about relationship contracts, when you think about the thing that you might have done, the way that you might have been, an action you might have taken, a characteristic or a quality that you would like to be, maybe even thought you had but were afraid to demonstrate, to show, to let other people know about. When you think about that, if you think about that, can you think of how your relationships might be affected if you changed that? If you started to laugh out loud at people's jokes, if you started to change your clothes so that they were what you actually want to wear and not what the rest of your crowd is wearing, or that makes your spouse happy, or that your children wouldn't tease you about, or whatever it is, you know, is there an activity that you always wanted to, did you want to learn to spin yarn? Did you want to learn to speak Greek? Did you want to travel to Istanbul? Did you, you know, is there anything that you turned your back on? And if you were to turn back to that, would that have an impact on any relationship in your life? So, these are just questions. If you have answers for them, or you don't have answers for them, you have more questions and you want to talk to me about it, again, thelinshow.com. In the meanwhile, as always, I sure hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that you know now that you didn't know, something that you had forgotten, that you remember, something that will bring you back. Because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang, no. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out.